So our 20-year plan specifically outlines a plan to make sure that we have water for the next 20 years. And it has the projects in there, it has all the data there, and if we follow that plan, we will have a safe, reliable source of drinking water in our county for the next 20 years.
Welcome to the Housing Advocate Podcast, presented by the Southern Utah Home Builders Association. I'm your host, Stacy Young. If you like the show, I hope you'll consider sharing it with someone you think will also enjoy it. Humans have lived in deserts for all of recorded history, and we've mined, stored, transported, and conserved water to make that possible for just about as long. And securing reliable fresh water is not just a challenge for desert cities. Whether it's the elaborate system of aqueducts and reservoirs connecting upstate watersheds to New York City, the huge national investments in desalination undertaken by Israel and the Gulf Arab states, or the comprehensive four national taps framework of Singapore, a wide variety of approaches are used to tackle the water problem for modern cities located in all sorts of climates all over the world. The age-old challenge of water scarcity certainly focuses the attention of the 40 million people who now make their home in the Colorado River Basin. If you live in Washington County, you hear the questions. You may have them yourself. How much water do we have? Is it enough to meet the needs of a population that continues to grow rapidly? Is the Lake Powell pipeline dead? Today, I have the pleasure of talking about these questions and more with Zach Grinstrom, General Manager of the Washington County Water Conservancy District. Welcome to the show, Zach.
It's good to be here.
Thanks. Thanks for doing this. So you and I have known each other for a really long time. I've been in, this is my 20th year in the St. George area, and I think I've known you almost that long. Mm-hmm. But for our listeners, maybe tell them a little bit about yourself and how you came to be in the hot seat you now occupy.
So my name is Zachary Renstrom. I'm the General Manager of the Washington County Water Conservancy District. And my background is both in civil engineering. So I have a degree in civil engineering from the University of Utah. And I also have a law degree. And so just the combination of the two really kind of puts me in this position really well. The other thing that really helped is I was a county commissioner for a while. And so I got to know the community, specifically Washington County. And so when this job opening came up, they put in my application, well, what they were requesting is they said, well, we want somebody that understands engineering, understands legal, and also the local community. And so it was a national search. They did open it up and they did get applications from all over, but I kind of had the lock on those three things.
Yeah, that makes for a pretty short list when you combine those three.
Yeah.
And it is a fantastic skill set for the role you're in. And certainly the exposure you would have had on the commission, you would have kind of gotten a running start at that as well. And then it seemed like there was also a really smart succession plan as you came in the door, right? Didn't you sort of job share for a while before you were solo in the role you're in now?
Yeah, so we had one full solid overlap with the former general manager, Ron Thompson. And it was nice. I kind of followed him around quite a bit, drove up to Salt Lake and to conferences, and he introduced me to a lot of the players in the water industry. And so that was very, very helpful. And it was a very positive time. And I really appreciate it. And even to this day, Ron will still come in and we'll call, and he's been really, really good about coming into the office and answering questions or just giving us background on information. It saves us a lot of time and effort.
Yeah, that continuity is great. And also you have a really great staff and team at the district as well. And we interface with some of them, but maybe talk about your larger team that is involved in this work.
Yeah, so we have about 65 employees up at the Water District, and it's because we have a very broad mission at the Water District. It's just not simply delivering water to a tap. One of the things we do is we have the Virgin River program, and that means we're making those fish in that river very, very happy. And so we have a full-time biologist that goes out there and monitors those fish and watches out after those fish. And so if anything ever occurs on the Virgin River, let's say they want to build a bridge, or they have a stormwater project, the first thing that those people generally contact the engineers is they go to the Virgin River program or our employee and talk about how they can do this in a river that has multiple species that are protected. And so that's like one of the other services that we do. And then, you know, we do a lot of things with recreation, just because when you have a big lake, people want to recreate on it. Mm-hmm. And so we have to have staff to manage all that.
Yeah. And probably some of that staff is then also probably managing relationships like with the State Parks Division and things like that as well, I would assume. Is that part of it a little bit?
Yeah. And I mean, so Sand Hollow Reservoir was listed as the number one visited state park in the state of Utah last year, and also the largest revenue. And so we'll get phone calls where people are upset about something. And so It just takes time to respond to that phone call. If we get a grammar request, to respond to that grammar request. And then also if somebody has a concern, just to respond to that. And a lot of times it's just transferring it to the right person at the state park, but it just takes time. And I mean, somebody has to be there.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, jumping into kind of the list of questions kind of on my mind and probably a lot of our listeners' mind, want to talk quite a bit about the near term. You recently have begun releasing your 20-year plan, and so I want to spend a good amount of time on that. But before we get to that, maybe I'd like to talk a little bit bigger picture, longer term, and talk about the Colorado River a little bit. So we know that there was a Colorado River Compact that was entered into decades ago, and there's a number of issues sort of surrounding that today. Could you maybe outline some of what those issues are, maybe just a little bit of that background?
That's a very complex question, and that, you know, volumes of books have been written on. Mm-hmm. But pretty much the basic assumption of those agreements that they made in 1922 weren't always exactly correct. And I look back, and they, at the time, they took everything that they had, the best knowledge they had, and kind of came up with a compact that they thought was fair and equitable to all parties. But since that time, we've learned more that the river doesn't operate exactly how they thought. So because of that, it's created some friction. And also, we've had a really bad drought the last 20 years that has put a lot of stress on the system. And whenever you stress the system, you start to find errors in the system. And that's what's happened. So the big conflict now is going back and trying to fix some of those errors that were made years ago and develop a better system that can deal with these conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Was at a kind of a high level, was part of the purpose of the compact to divvy up sort of the river's total outflow in a way that was a little bit more forward-looking as opposed to sort of every state racing to maximize its use of that resource? Is that somewhat right?
So there was a decision by the Supreme Court doing nothing with the Colorado River, but all of a sudden it triggered a panic on the Colorado River. And so the states immediately started fighting, and everybody could see this massive conflict coming. In fact, there's a famous story that actually occurred where Arizona sent troops over into California to fight about water. And there was all this friction going on. And so really the 1922 compact was a way for the states to get together to resolve a massive amount of conflict that was starting to occur, and also water grabs and fighting over water. And it worked really well for 100 years. And even the foundation is there for us to continue on. And so it really was solving a major problem, and it's worked really well. And they're all passed away, of course, but those individuals worked very hard to come up with something that's still working fairly well today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, and maybe to back up a little bit. So the Colorado River Basin states is 7 states, right? And so it's divided into upper basin and lower basin states. And so the upper basin states are Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, right? And there's a few nuances to this, but basically that's the short version. And then the lower states are the lower basin states are Arizona, Nevada, and California, right?
Correct.
And the allocation was 50-50 lower basin to upper basin, and then each individual state kind of had a share allocated out of that, right?
That was the notion, but now we've learned there's lots of problems with that premise.
Maybe talk about some of those.
So it was assumed for years and years that the upper basin state received 7.5 million acre feet of water, and the lower basin state also gets 7.5 million acre feet to allocate to their states. Well, the upper basin states, due to some interesting nuances of the law, they account for all the evaporation that occurs in the upper basin states, while the lower basin does nothing for evaporation. That evaporation accounts for, you know, depending on the levels and everything, about 1 million acre feet of water.
Wow.
So in a system that was kind of, there was assumption, the way that the lower and basin states treat that assumption differently equates to a lot of water.
Right.
And so that's one of the friction points that are coming up, is basically saying to the lower basin states, there's already 1 million acre feet deficit in what you're doing right now. How are you going to fix that? Mm-hmm. And Arizona and Nevada have an idea, and California thinks it's wrong.
Okay.
So there's a lot of things that there was excess water in the system, no one really talked about. Now that we really are pushing up against every single drop of water, these things have kind of come out of it, of like how we're going to deal with it.
Right. And that's a great example. Yeah. And so where that process stands is, I understand that there's sort of a new deadline to reach a new set of agreements. Could you talk about a little bit about when that is and kind of what shape that is taking?
So the agreement that everybody talks about is called the interim guidelines. And basically the interim guidelines talk about how Lake Mead and Lake Powell will operate, literally how they will open the valves on those reservoirs to allow the water to flow through. So in the last interim agreement, it allowed the federal government to take excess water from Lake Powell and move it down to Lake Mead. And then once it got to Lake Mead, that water was able to get distributed among the lower basin states. That agreement has caused problems because it essentially allowed Lake Powell to drop a lot faster and allowed Lake Mead to be, you know, buoyed up, but then it allowed the people in the lower basin states to take that water out of Lake Mead. Mm-hmm. So it kind of created a problem. Now, when they came up with the interim guidelines, no one really thought we'd have this big of a drought. And also, like, the state of Utah wasn't as involved. Mm-hmm. So now that we realize that if we go back to the original compact, how much water was supposed to be supplied to the lower basin states, we're millions of acre feet above that compact allowance that we've allowed to flow down to the lower basin states. If that water was still into Lake Powell, Lake Powell would probably be about 60-70% full instead of more like right now it's in the 30s. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is just going back to those compacts. Well, going back to the compact and talking about how are we going to operate Lake Powell and how are we going to operate Lake Mead. Are we going to have a Lake Powell that is completely 100% full while Lake Mead is completely empty, or vice versa? And that's the discussion that's going on. The upper basin states, of course, we are very adamant that Lake Powell should be protected and that they should use Lake Mead as, you know, kind of balance their yearly quotas and stuff like that. And so mm-hmm. there's a lot of fight over that because the lower basin states want to keep Lake Mead up really high and Lake Powell really low. For example, Arizona gets a certain amount of water based upon the elevation of Lake Mead. And so if Lake Mead's really high, they'll get more water. So all of a sudden you start doing these inner playing of like, well, if we keep the reservoir here or that, we'll allow this and that and that. And there have been bad players on the river where they've tried to manipulate the system. And that's part of the big problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, let's go into a couple of those actually. They raised some really interesting questions. So one of them, I note that, you know, Havasu, we never talk about Havasu not being full, right? That, mm-hmm. And that's, as I understand it, both of the big straws, both to California and Arizona, are into Havasu. And so that's part of the reason why that thing is always kept super mm-hmm. full. Is that right? And then upstream, you know, especially in Utah, we have a fair amount of concern about Flaming Gorge, and that's a big part of our watershed as well. So those two big reservoirs are also sort of that shock absorbers in the middle of the system, but then there's these upstream and downstream considerations as well, I'm sure. You mentioned also that Utah has become a little bit more engaged in this process. Could you talk a little bit more about that, kind of what the background was to that and what Utah's response has been?
So the original compact allowed the states to each appoint a representative to go and represent the state. And the state of Utah, we had multiple individuals over the year, but really was just kind of like a side job. They had either departments or operations that they had to run, and they'd kind of do the Colorado River on the side. And in my opinion, the state of Utah got taken advantage of because we weren't really studying it. And where it really came to light is I went with the state of Utah down to Arizona, and we go walking into a room, and in this room, there were three attorneys and multiple engineers, and all they did full time was do nothing but the mainstream of the Colorado River. In Utah, we had somebody doing it part time. And we were completely outgunned. We knew these interim guidelines were coming up. We knew all the discussions that were coming, and basically we weren't prepared. So I went to some key individuals within the state of Utah, including our now Governor Cox and shared, and some other people went to the governor and says, we've got a big problem. A big fight is coming on the river and we're not prepared for this fight. And so we reached out to the legislature, and it was interesting in talking to the president of the Senate and also the speaker of the House, and they quickly realized it. And so that year there was a bill that was a joint bill between the president and the speaker of the House. And which means if you get those two individuals, the sponsor bill, it will go through. And it flew through. Like, it was bipartisan. Everybody agreed Utah needs to be prepared. And it formed the Colorado River Authority of Utah and basically gave money to create staff, to hire attorneys, and also to hire engineers to really start modeling everything. And it's been interesting, in a relative short period of time, just a few years, Utah went to literally being in the back of the room where now we're at the table and we're having discussions. And so if something's proposed, we can quickly run the numbers on it and see how that will actually operate and how it'll function. We're also putting a lot more money into just data collection, so we have better data. So we can really go and say, hey, when we go into those negotiations, we can really fight for Utah's right.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. Yeah, that's like you said, that's in a fairly short amount of time then that we've really ramped up as a state response to the issue, which is heartening. And you know, at the root of that, what we're really trying to do is make sure that Utah's interests are protected in those discussions. And so maybe to talk about a little bit where we stand today. So we know that, like you said, the some of the allotments under the compact ended up being out of whack to the actual hydrology of the river, especially today. But if we use that as a benchmark, could you kind of walk me through approximately how much of that share each of the states is using?
So that's one of the big issues on the river. So a lot of these states right after the compact, they went and quickly developed their water as fast as they could. And Utah took the approach of being much more conservative. And there was discussions about that, like, hey, we have this entitlement to the Colorado River. So instead of rushing out and developing and do this, like this other work that other basin states are doing, let's be more thoughtful and conservative about this. Well, now that we come to our point, like one of the proposals is okay, whatever you have, that's what you get to keep. Well, that's not fair to Utah that took a different approach, a more conservative approach, a more wise approach, in my opinion, than some of these other states.
Right.
But yet that's what their proposal is. And that's where it's good now that we have a team in place to respond to that, saying that's not fair. Just because Utah was wise in its water development, we shouldn't be punished.
Right.
So you need to give us at least more room or more discretion in that. And so other states that have rushed out or used over their allocation, they need to come back. And so that's where all this discussion start going down is, if every basin state just said, okay, everybody takes a 20% cut off what they're allocated, the river balances. Mm-hmm. If that was the case, Utah would be flush with water. We'd have more water than we even are proposing if you looked at all our projects. But yet that proposal would kill the state of Colorado. Mm-hmm. So that's where,
right.
So where that's all going to come in. Yeah, uh-huh. A lot of tension.
Sounds like there's kind of some sort of third alternative, because if you just applied it in across the board haircut relative to the compact, that's going to affect some states differently. If you apply it based on current usage, that also has some unfairness baked into it. And for us locally, obviously, one of the considerations around that is we feel like there ought to be the ability to eventually build the Lake Powell pipeline, or is that dead?
No, it's part of the discussion. And what people don't understand is the Virgin River is part of the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. And so when they're having discussions about the Colorado River, they're looking at the Virgin River. And so it's been very interesting to me that the Virgin River is kind of, because it's a small tributary, has not reached certain levels. But now there are people that are looking at the Virgin River. And so not only do they look at what the state of Utah is doing, they're looking at what we're doing on the Virgin River and how that will affect it. And so some of the fighting is just over the Virgin River and what they're proposing would happen on the Virgin River that would be, it would just kill us locally. Mm-hmm. And so we have to fight for that.
Yeah. And again, it kind of, to me, it does relate a lot back to what you were saying about the compact, that the intent to that was to give states a little bit, or at least one of the intents was to give states a little bit more predictability about their ultimate water supply. And so they could be more aggressive in the development of that water or less so. And, you know, in fact, it was interesting. I happened upon an article just a few weeks ago. I didn't realize it was this much. I knew transbasin diversions were common in Colorado, but I didn't realize how much it was. I think the thing I read was something like 24 total transbasin diversions to serve the Front Range. That about half of their water serving the 5 million people or so on the Front Range is coming from the other side of the Continental Divide. So, you know, we certainly think about the lower basin states and, you know, and more power to them in my view. But at the same time, it does seem like we in Utah ought to be able to have a similar shot at a reasonable allocation of the Colorado River water.
Yeah.
So that's maybe enough about the Colorado River for now and the Lake Powell pipeline. But to move to a little more near-term considerations, the 20-year plan that I alluded to earlier that you're publishing now, Could you talk a little bit about that, kind of at a thumbnail level, and then we can maybe dig into some of the details of that?
Yeah, so through the years, you know, the district has always looked at different water projects and kind of analyzed them. And with the Lake Powell Pipeline, when they did that analysis, the Lake Powell Pipeline, that water was cheaper. Even though you had to pump it a long time, because of the volume of water that you would receive, that was one of the reasons why we're focusing on the Lake Powell Pipeline. Well, now because of the politics and everything that's going on in the river, we know there's going to be a delay. So I went to my staff and said, okay, any idea that you've ever heard of, let's pull off the shelf and talk about it, and let's go through and evaluate it. And so we went through and we looked at a lot of them. So like water reuse, we've talked about that for a long time here, but it was never economically feasible. Well, now, since we're running out of other local water supplies, we're bringing that back. And so that 20-year plan basically just goes through and looks at all the different projects, the amount of availability of water we could get from that project, and developing a 20-year plan. And so if the cities and everyone agrees to follow the plan, then we should have a safe, reliable source of drinking water for the next 20 years with a healthy, abundant amount of growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So some of those underlying assumptions, as I recall, you're using forecasted population growth in line with what the state demographers are projecting. So, you know, somewhere around 70,000 connections over that amount of time, 150,000 people, give or take. Is that right?
Roughly? Yeah. And that's just based upon the numbers given to us from the University of Utah and the governor's office. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think those numbers make sense. And then the other sort of set of underlying assumptions has a little bit to do, as I understand it, with, you know, one of the questions that comes up a lot of times, kind of the first question that people have, is how much water do we have and how much do we use? And as it turns out, that's a little more complicated question than it may seem on its face, right? I mean, I think you alluded to it earlier, there's even a distinction, I think, especially between the lower basin and upper basin states in terms of how they account for water. So as I understand it, we've also made a few changes in that in Utah to make comparisons a little bit more apples to apples. Could you talk about that a little bit?
So when we look at the numbers, and a lot of times we get compared to Las Vegas, and when you compare us to Las Vegas in just the quick numbers, it shows that people in St. George use 3 times more water than somebody in Las Vegas. But the problem is you're looking at depletion versus diversion, and it's a big difference. And so the legislature said, we need to help the public understand this and come up with a simpler method. So we want our water districts to start calculating depletion, not diversion. And so when we look at those numbers, our numbers are much more closer to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah, because I think I heard, I can't remember if it was you or someone else, maybe one of the city's water departments, really significant share of the water that we take out of the Virgin ends up back in the Virgin, right? It's a very sizable share. And so that, assuming that's kind of the distinction between diversion and depletion. So if you're putting it back into the same river, then you're not depleting it, you're just diverting it. Is that kind of the short version?
So we take it out of the river and we have a meter and you use it and then you return it back to the river. And there is less water. There's no question about that. But the question is how much less water? Mm-hmm. And we've never calculated that in the state of Utah, where most of the Western United States does that method, which makes sense. Like if you're going to return, sure, you should just subtract that off.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, hopefully that'll make it a little bit easier. And that also kind of informs some of the calculations even. So that understanding of it is one thing that it helps. But then there's also a little bit of shift in state policy around our source requirements, and there's a little bit more flexibility around that as well. So maybe talk about that a little bit, if you wouldn't mind.
So a lot of our rules and regulations in regards to drinking water were developed in the 80s. And once again, it worked really well in the 80s, and that's when they were developed. But we now have better data. We actually have ways to collect data a lot better. And so a lot of it is the legislature going out and asking the state to update their policies. And so we're kind of in that process right now. And so one of the ways that we were able to do that is the state used to come down and mandate how much water each house had to be able to take from the system. Now we're able to go in and actually look at what is our current residents using. And if we do water conservation and be good stewards of water, could we lower that amount down? And so that flexibility allows us to adapt. and have a more robust system.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the old standard was really a statewide thing, right? So it treated it the same whether you were in Summit County or Washington County, for example. And so there's a much more fine-tuned approach, it seems like. And just making that accounting adjustment alone frees up at least some water on paper. Is that right? So there's kind of a distinction between how we account for it on in terms of our planning and all of that and how much is coming out of the tap a little bit, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's a better system now because we have better data and we should adapt to that data. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they're allowing us to do.
Yeah, makes sense. It seemed as I looked at the 20-year plan, the by far the two biggest components of that were the reuse that you alluded to and conservation. And it feels like we've two things have happened, I guess I would say, in my estimation. You correct me where you may disagree, but it seemed like we were actually walking the conservation path for quite a while. It just was maybe not as publicized. It was maybe kind of just sort of happening through a variety of mechanisms. So I think one of the statistics I've seen from your office is that we trimmed our per capita water use by about 30% between 2000 and 2020, which is significant. I think that's the most in the state, in fact. And so, you know, back to that narrative, sometimes we're sometimes kind of shorthanded as water wasters in Washington County, but in reality, the last 20 years, we've been doing pretty well on that. And then the second piece being making it explicit now that we're really going to put an effort on the conservation side of things. And I guess it's been about a year and a half ago, we as a county more or less adopted conservation standards as applied to new construction. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that process and how well you think that's working or not?
So yeah, it's been interesting to me that in a short amount of time, I'd go into conferences and people wouldn't even talk to me because from where I was at. In fact, I applied to an organization. It's a trade organization. They rejected my application because where I was from, because they said, you guys are so horrible with water. And a lot of it was messaging. We hadn't got out the message of what we've been doing. And there's no doubt that a home built in the 90s used a significant amount more water here than a home built up, say, in Utah County in the 90s. But since that time, there's been so much change, and especially lately. And so now the homes that we're building are the most water efficient homes in the state of Utah, some of the most water efficient homes in the Western United States. And so we're finally getting credit for what all the hard work we've done down here. And it has been hard. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion and it's taken a lot of time. But now I can go to the state and say, hey, we're doing our part. And what's nice is we're being recognized that. And so the state legislature has actually given us a lot of funds recently because of this hard work that we've been doing down here. And we are getting recognized for what we're doing down here. And the interesting thing about it is homes are still selling and people love these new mm-hmm. homes. And once they see how beautiful the landscaping can be with zero scaping, that's what a lot of people are starting to request. And so it was just a matter of getting a couple of key people in places, a couple of key organizations in places, and also just letting people see that. And most people are very, very, very happy with how we're proceeding. It was very interesting to me that when I sat down and I realized where we need to proceed and how we're going to keep our economy growing here. And it really did get to that point where I was thinking I'd go for my morning runs and all I could think about was what's going to happen. Like, how will I answer a phone call where somebody's like, I just got laid off because there's no water and it's your fault. And it was very heavy on my shoulders. And so the engineer in me started calculating all this, and I realized what we need to do. We need to be better stewards. That was clear. And we needed this clear method. So I reached out to a lot of organizations, and it was interesting because I reached out to environmental firms or organizations that I thought that they would jump on board and they would do everything they could to help me. And I reached out to business, and I reached out to the home builders. And, you know, one of the main entities I reached out to is the Southern Home Builders Association. Well, when it came time to really start saying, hey, we're going to do this, it was the home builders organization that was one of the leaders in that. Like, they went there, they spent the time reviewing all the numbers. They had a lot of good questions. They spent a lot of their time. And I know a lot of them didn't even get paid for this, but they wanted to know it. And once they realized it, they were the ones that were going to the city councils. They were the ones that were talking. They were the ones building the homes. And so it was very interesting, though, at those meetings, the environmental groups didn't even show up. And if they did, they sat in the back room and they said nothing, or they'd be a little bit critical. But to actually make something happen, it was the home builders, because they were one of the leaders. Now, the realtors were really good and a few other people, but really it was the industries and the people that had, you know, that were concerned about the economy growing that showed up to those meetings saying, hey, we need to be better stewards of our water.
Yeah, appreciate that. Yeah, and we, you know, I think a lot of our membership, you know, we don't just build here. You know, sometimes there's almost this narrative as if we're almost strip miners or something in the community, and that's just not who we are. We live here, we raise our families here, and so that long-term future of the community really matters to us. And so, you know, on one level, people can say, well, that's in your self-interest because you want to keep building homes, and that's the case. But the reason we want to build homes is because, again, we live here and we want to see a future here. We don't. You know, and I think for me personally, the other issue is it's above my pay grade to even begin to figure out what the consequences would be if we just didn't accommodate the growth that seems to still be coming our way. So we feel the same way about your organization. We feel like it's, you know, we've developed a much better working relationship over recent years, and feel like we understand a lot better what your challenges are and where we might be helpful. And so we appreciate that. So the policy stuff can be challenging. We have a good group of members that get engaged on that level, but the day-to-day is maybe not as glamorous or whatever, but you know, we feel like we're also kind of part of the solution that way. Most of the cities now are requiring that subdivision construction, that we install a second water system, essentially a parallel water system with the culinary network of pipes and meters to deliver irrigation grade water to homes. And of course we pay impact fees as well that go into the sort of capital facilities budget for the larger scale water works and so on. Could you talk a little bit about how those fit into your overall portfolio of planning around how to make these things work both financially and as a sort of planning and engineering matter?
So our county is so beautiful because of the topography, but that topography also makes it very tricky. And so our water quality changes substantially throughout the county. And so we have very, very, very strict rules on drinking water and testing that water, making sure it's just perfect when it comes through the tap that you can drink it. But the lawn doesn't necessarily need that. The lawn just needs a certain grade of water to grow. And so when we look at our water availability, we realize we do have water that we could just put on the lawns with no problem. But yet to take that water and treat it to a drinking water standard is astronomically high just in capital costs and also in just operating the system. And so to have a dual system where we can use lower grade water for the lawns or just any vegetation outside and the drinking water for indoors, in the long run, it's actually cheaper. And we'll have more water in the system too. And so one of the things that we're proposing is we're going to take our sewer water, we're going to treat it to a higher grade, and then we'll put it in that secondary line that can go on somebody's grass. And the grass will do great with it. The desert shrubs or anything, they'll do just fine with that. But you don't want to drink it. And so why not save that really high quality water that we do want to drink and save that for inside and then swap it out? And so that's what we really looked at. And that's one of the ways that we're also proceeding.
So as we build out this secondary water system, what's kind of the rollout and the timetable around that? And also, I think there's some bigger storage projects that also fit into that. Could you kind of talk about the timetable for some of those benchmarks?
So what the reuse, one thing that is nice about it is we can kind of phase it. It's just not one big project. And so we're going to phase it over the next 15 years. So we actually are doing reuse right now in our county. And so we're just going to slowly ramp that up as it's needed. So we don't want to go build an infrastructure and just let it sit there and age.
Right.
So right now we're looking at building a reservoir on the west side of the county. We're looking at either dry wash or graveyard. And so in Tokerville, which we've actually put the bid out right now for construction on that, those facilities will all be reuse. But some of the big infrastructure too, like possibly the Warner Valley Reservoir, that's probably like 10 or 15, maybe even 20 years out.
Gotcha.
It just depends on how fast we grow.
Great. And then jumping back a little bit for just a second on the conservation side of the ledger, it seems like one of the great recent hires was Doug Bennett, who helped build the conservation program in Las Vegas. Is that right? He Yes. Tell us a little bit more about Doug and what initiatives he's working on these days.
So he has been a phenomenal hire. And so one of my jobs is to go hire people that are smarter than me. And he's definitely one of them. And so he's moved around a little bit, but where he is recognized the most is in Southern Nevada Water Authority. They were looking at massive shortages and a lot of the problems we're kind of facing. And so he came on to the Water Authority at that point. And so at the time, Southern Nevada Water Authority was running out, trying just tons of different programs and seeing what would work and what wouldn't. And they learned a lot through that, through mistakes, and they learned what worked well. So instead of kind of trying to either copy that or recreate it or make our own mistakes, we heard that he was retiring. Mm. And so we started the process of courting, for lack of a better word. And so we reached out to him, and he had multiple offers from all over the Western United States.
Yeah.
But he wanted to move here. And so he was excited to move here. So we were able to negotiate a salary for him to move here. And he's been a phenomenal success already, because a lot of the ideas that we were kind of thinking, he came in, he's like, yeah, that's not going to work. So don't even waste your time with that. Mm-hmm. But if you try this over here, it will. And the other thing that he has a really good skill set is just working with people. He's very personable.
That's a great way about him. Yep.
He's very calm. So I've sent him into some heated situations. And just because of his demeanor, he calms the situation, diffuses a lot of situations, and people leave after talking to him very positive about moving forward. And so, yeah, phenomenal individual. We're very lucky to have him.
Mm-hmm. And is the turf rebate program kind of under that umbrella, or how is that working?
Yeah, so it was something new we were trying, and so we were kind of having some growing pains. It's just new this year. And so we brought him on, and he instantly said, oh, this is what you need to do to make it successful. And so he hired a bunch of interns. He tweaked our computer program that we were using to make it much more efficient. And he also just wanted to talk about how do we make it easy for the users? Mm-hmm. And he had already been through this entire process. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, well, you need to do all these things. And so we quickly adapted it. Now that's all under him. And he's just been phenomenal and made something that was becoming a bureaucratic nightmare into something that's streamlined.
That's great. It sounds like that's a good problem to have. It sounds like the adoption then is going pretty well. Are a lot of people taking you up on that program?
Yeah. So we have about 1,500 applicants right now.
Wow.
And we really haven't even advertised. The money's starting to flow out. So it takes some time that they go out and measure it. You do the conversion, then we go back out and measure it. And so it's neat to start seeing those numbers coming in. And he just has it really streamlined, where you file an application and you'll get an email explaining where you're at in the application and how everything's going smooth. And we didn't really tell anybody about it. We just kind of put it out there and see the success. And so we know there's a lot more in the market that will absorb it. And we get phone calls all the time of people wanting to, you know more about it because they just heard it from a neighbor. So we think we're going to start advertising and start talking about it a little bit, partly because the state of Utah is promising us that if all of a sudden we do have a flood of applicants, that they will help come in, reinforce us, and give us financial means to make sure we can continue the program. But it's been going really well, and people have been, for the most part, people have been very, very happy.
So one of the things that you hear pretty commonly, especially if you end up online anywhere, is that just we're flat out of water. Is there any truth to that? How does that actually square with reality?
So our 20-year plan specifically outlines a plan to make sure that we have water for the next 20 years. And it has the projects in there. It has all the data in there. And if we follow that plan, we will have a safe, reliable source of drinking water in our county for the next 20 years.
It's great to hear. So one last question for you, just to wrap it up. Are you able to start to, is enough time passed for you to be able to start to see some of these measures in sort of year over year water utilization? I know you guys wholesale the water to the city, so I don't know what level of data you get sort of real time, but can you talk to that question a little bit?
The tricky thing with that question is the variability of our environment. And so, like a couple of years ago, we went 155 days without any measurable rainfall, and it was just hot.
Right.
So we used a lot of water. And then last summer, we got some really good monsoons. Mm-hmm. This season, we've actually been a little bit cooler with some good monsoons. And so even though we've grown as a community, our overall water use in the last 2 years has actually decreased.
Wow.
And so it's hard to say how much of that was just because it's been a little bit wetter. But even in the winter months, we see that people are using less water. And so you start to see a statistical trend, and we're seeing that, and that's been very, very positive. And then we do look at meter data, just how people's meters are spinning. And when somebody takes out the grass, we, like, within a month, we see that.
Wow.
So there's definitely, we're starting to see that data already. And I'm sure as we get the longer duration of time of statistical data that we, well, just data that we can do, apply the statistics to it and show that overall trend.
That's great to hear. Yeah, we won't run out and spike the football yet. You make a good, that's a good asterisk that things are variable, and so we need to keep our focus on where it is. But that is encouraging to hear. Thanks again, Zach, for joining us on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation. I bet our listeners did too.
Thank you so much for having us. If people have additional questions, they can go to our website, wcwcd.org. And we put a lot of information on there where we talk about our individual projects. We talk about key staffers, or people just have general questions. That's the first thing. If they want to learn about the grass rebate, that's where they would go to.
Yeah, that's a great note. Yeah, because you do. Your website's fantastic. A lot of great information there. People can get very well informed just at their own leisure online. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's good talking to you.
Always good to see you, Zach. See you.